This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Elizabeth Buemiller, says the story of women in India is one of paradoxes. Most of the 400 million women live in villages, where some are forced into an endless day of working in the fields and taking care of the home. Others follow the Islamic tradition of purdah and are not allowed to leave the house at all. Violence against women is common, and the birth of a daughter is considered a calamity. But on the other hand, India produced one of the most powerful female leaders in the world, Indira Gandhi. Elizabeth Buemiller lived in India from 1985 to 1988. She was a reporter for the Style section of the Washington Post when her husband, Stephen Weissman, was sent by the New York Times to cover India. Buemiller went along and began reporting from India for the Post. She's written a book titled May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, A Journey Among the Women of India. She writes about the women of the cities and the villages, powerless women, and the growing feminist movement. Buemiller writes that being in India changed her mind about feminism.
I think what it did was sort of reaffirmed or emphasized some sort of vague beliefs that I had before I left. Until I went to India, I had had sort of a conventional belief in feminism. I had been raised in the 1970s in Cincinnati, and I think I to a large extent, reaped the benefits of the feminist movement in the 60s, and I naturally assumed I would have a profession. But I don't think my feminism went much beyond that, and I think after experiencing India and meeting all these women, I think my feminism took on a larger context. I think I saw that feminism is not just about the sort of self-absorbed determination to have a career of one's own.
Why did you start writing about women in India?
Well, I hadn't originally wanted to. I had been very self-conscious about going to India with my husband, so the wife sort of following her husband to India. And I had not wanted to write what I considered the predictable woman's book. About women in India, even though many people have suggested to me this would be a wonderful topic. But as I began reporting in India for the Washington Post, it was the stories that I wrote about women that touched me the deepest. The first year I was there, I met a woman who had been burned by her husband because she had not brought enough dowry to her marriage. And I met village women who touched me. I met young, educated women in the big cities who had arranged marriages and thought this was perfectly all right. So I felt that the women were my way into India, my way of understanding a very complicated, complex country.
I think it's difficult for an American woman, particularly an American feminist woman, to be in another culture that is not only not a feminist culture, but a culture where traditionally women are considered to be less valuable than men. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you project your values onto the society, or do you try to distance yourself and say, well, that's their culture, and who am I to pass judgment, and so on? Was this a big issue for you as you went around to cities and villages interviewing women?
Yes, it certainly was. I wrestled with it every day. I was very, very aware of my own cultural baggage, my own preconceptions, whatever you want to call it. I tried to understand what was going on in each situation. I tried to understand arranged marriages. I tried to understand the reasons for dowry. But then at the end, I felt that I had to judge because I had in a book. You know, you have to come to some conclusions. I couldn't just be, as I had been in the past, an unbiased reporter for the Washington Post. I had to come to some decisions, and so I did make judgments. And it'll be interesting to see what other Indian women think of those judgments.
My guest is Elizabeth Buemiller, who writes for the Washington Post, and she was in India for several years, and her new book is about women in India. It's called May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons. Now, the title of your book, May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, that comes from a Hindu blessing for brides. Is it still considered a disaster to have a female child, to give birth to a girl?
Well, of course, not in all segments of society in India. Among the the upper middle class, among the very educated classes, girls are welcome. But I would say, in general, I would say absolutely in general, the birth of a boy is a joyous occasion, and a much more joyous occasion than the birth of a girl. And in many, many parts of society, the birth of a girl is viewed as a calamity still, certainly in villages and in rural India.
What makes having a girl a calamity?
Well, certainly right now, there's a lot of things, but the biggest issue right now in India is dowry. Dowry is, you know, the gifts and the cash that is that the bride's family has to give to the groom's family at the time of her wedding. And in India today, dowry has been escalating beyond all proportions to a family's ability to pay it. For instance, it's not unusual for a man who makes $800 a year to have to pay a dowry worth $3,000 for his daughter, and that includes, you know, a motorcycle, a refrigerator, a television set. This is the biggest problem right now. I think, you know, and there are many families who feel they simply cannot afford another girl. And if you ask, if you tell these families, yes, but why don't you just refuse to pay dowry? It's they feel it's just not an option, and that they will never marry off their daughter without it.
Do all women have dowries when they get married?
No, not all. I mean, again, among the very among some of the elite, there is not dowry. These are very westernized, educated people who abhor a dowry and refuse to pay it. And then certainly among some lower castes in the villages, there is no dowry. It's not completely widespread, but what is significant is that it is spreading. Traditionally, dowry was the preserve of the upper castes, of the Brahmins in particular, but in recent years it has been spreading to lower castes. And so, for instance, I was in a village in the South Indian state of Tamil Nadu, and I met, you know, farm laborers who said that they were now paying dowry, and it had only been in the last 5 years that they had to do that, because they had said that the rich people in town are paying it, and so we feel now that we must pay it, and it is being demanded of us before we can marry off our daughters.
Amniocentesis has made it possible for a pregnant woman to find out whether she's carrying a boy or a girl. And
yes.
There was, I know a few years ago in India, there was a lot of abortions of female fetuses. Is that still going on?
Well, it was, I'm sure it is, but officially it was made illegal in 1988, right before I left. I had gone to Bombay in 1987, the spring of 87, and done some reporting. I had talked to women who had used amniocentesis to determine whether or not the fetus they were carrying was a boy or a girl. And if the fetus was a girl, in most cases they would have the fetus aborted because they felt they could not, afford the cost of another girl. This was happening at such alarming numbers in Bombay and in the states surrounding it that in 1988 the Maharashtra State Assembly, that state legislature, Maharashtra is the state of which Bombay is the capital, banned such a test. And when I left India, there was a discussion underway in New Delhi that there should be a nationwide ban as well. Anyway, it was made illegal in Maharashtra, but many doctors and feminists felt that it would just women would just go across the border into neighboring states and have it done there. But at least it was a deterrent.
What's the cultural explanation for the dowry?
Cultural explanation? Well, I think you could just say that when dowry... Well, there's two things at work here. One is that women are still largely viewed as chattel, as property, and therefore, if you need to, as a liability in a family, therefore, to get rid of the liability, to pass your daughter on to her in-laws' family, you have to pay them. You have to give them large amounts of money to take on take on your liability. But what's also at work, I think, is that there's among the middle class in India in the last decade, there has been an economic boom. The middle class is doing quite well, and dowry is now seen as a way of moving up on the economic scale. The dowries have become so large that a groom's family sees this as a great opportunity of increasing their wealth. And this is it's considered a very serious problem in India now, where materialism and a consumer boom has actually fueled dowry.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things that troubled you was all the arranged marriages that you saw in India.
Well, Let's see. I don't know if it troubles me. Certainly, I don't think it's a good idea for all of us, but for Americans. But I went into it sort of with an. I tried to go into it with an open mind, feeling that you know, in India, we're in the upper middle classes, where young women are not allowed to date. They don't have much chance to meet men before they're married. The new kind of arranged marriage that does exist, where a woman's family goes out and looks actively for a possible husband, finds one, presents him to the woman, and then they go out, say, for 6 months and see whether it takes. And the woman has the right to say no. I don't think this is so horrible. But I don't think, arranged marriage is the most serious problem, certainly, of Indian women. I just think it's more of a symptom of a society that views women as property.
When you spend time with couples whose marriages were arranged, could you feel any difference? Did it seem any different than American couples who loved each other very much, at least when they got married?
Well, it's hard. It's very hard to know what's going on in someone else's marriage. I certainly wouldn't want to tell you. But among some of our friends in India, I felt that some of the marriages that had been sort of semi-arranged, you know, I felt that the couples sometimes didn't seem as if they were friends. It was more the marriage is more of a social construct. It was a marriage between two families of common background, and I didn't feel that they were looking for the closeness that we strive for in our marriages under the best circumstances. Don't always find, but which we consider an ideal.
When you spoke to both men and women who were in arranged marriages, did they defend the practice?
Oh, certainly. They felt that, and it was very interesting, they felt that arranged marriages did work. They felt that Americans had it all wrong, and they often pointed to our divorce rate as evidence of this. They said that, in their view, Americans view love as passion. We view true love as passion, which inevitably wears off after the first 3 or 4 years, and then we're stuck with each other, and of course then we become very disappointed and we get divorced. That was their view of American marriage. In their view, what they do in India is that, you know, they have a set of parents who have the foresight to find a suitable groom for a daughter. And so then the first few years, there's a great deal of passion, as in any new relationship. But then when that passion wears off, as is inevitable, it's very fortunate that there were parents around who had the intelligence and the wisdom to find two people who had some compatibility and who had common interests. That, in their view, is... And then they feel also that after those first few years, this is when true love sets in, that the true love, which is commitment to family, devotion, loyalty... this can only happen after marriage, not before.
Elizabeth, you spent time with women in the high caste, the highest caste, and women who are poor. You spent time in the cities, time in the villages. Are the issues in the feminist movement different in different parts of India and among different castes of women?
Yes, they are. The women's movement in India, which... without making it too complicated, is the current women's movement in India has its basis in improving the lives of rural women, I would say, of village women. But that's a very difficult task, especially when the leaders of the women's movement are women from the large cities, from educated elite families. So rather than within the American women's movement, where the leaders of the movement sort of took the concerns of their own lives, of their personal concerns, and made them political, to paraphrase Gloria Steinem, the leaders of the women's movement in India have had to understand the problems of women who are enormously different from them, and before they can move forward. So there's a different impulse in India, I think, and it is the movement has borrowed some from Western feminism, but it doesn't completely translate.
Mm-hmm. Can you briefly give us a sense of what the different issues are in the city and in rural communities for women in India?
Well, in the villages, the issues are fuel, fodder, and water, to use a phrase that was used over and over again. You know, women aren't so much concerned with their rights as they are with getting enough water and having it close enough to their home so they don't have to walk an hour a day just for a pail of water they can carry on their heads. They need to have access to good, suitable grasses for their cows to eat. And they need to have access also to some sort of fuel so they can cook the meals for the family. It's there's survival issues in the villages. In the cities, of course, the issues are more, I won't say ideological, the issues are more, I think in recent years the issue has been come under the general heading of violence against women. What the feminists have done in the large cities is they have brought to the attention of the media and also to the national leaders, is all sorts of crimes against women. For instance, the dowry deaths and dowry. I mean, those issues would not have gotten the attention they had if there hadn't been very vocal leaders of the women's movement in the large cities bringing these to the forefront.
You spend time in a village with a wealthy family of the higher caste.
Right.
Where the woman, the wife, lived in seclusion. It's called purdah.
Right.
What is life like when you live in purdah?
Well, it's not, it's mostly you stay inside your house. It's interesting you say that I lived with a wealthy family. Yes, it was a wealthy family by village standards, but this did not mean that she sort of relaxed all day. What she did was she lived in a house that it was a brick house, mud and brick house, and there was all family activity occurred in a sort of a central courtyard that was open to the sky with a mud floor. There was no electricity. There was no running water. The water came from a well, and at night we all ate by firelight. What she did the woman of the house did all day was chores. She did not. I never saw her rest. I think I saw her rest briefly in the middle of the day when it was very hot, when everyone else took her rest as well.
When a woman lives in Purdah, she's not allowed out of the house?
No, I should say she did not leave the house. She came as far as the front door, and that was it. Now, this was how she spent most of her days. And if you asked her, well, wouldn't you like to go out in the village, she would say, well, why? What's there to see out there? That was sort of her attitude.
What is the explanation for purdah? What is it supposed to accomplish to keep the woman at home?
Well, what it does, among the upper castes in this village, it was just a sign of their status, that they had women, they had enough money that they could did not need to have their women work in the fields, and that the women were to be kept inside. It was a great sign of privilege and of status, and it was unthinkable that such a woman would have wandered outside with the lower caste women of the village. And, you know, while you and I can say that's ridiculous, that doesn't make any sense, why don't you just leave the house, it's not so simple. It would never have been done.
My guest is Elizabeth Buemiller. She's a journalist who writes for The Washington Post, and she's the author of the new book, May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, A Journey Among the Women of India. She lived in India from 1985 to 88. Your take on women in villages is that women in the upper caste are prisoners. They live in purdah, in seclusion, and they can't really leave their house, whereas the peasant women are slaves. They have to work all the time and for next to no money. Is that a fair analysis?
It's strong, but it's what I wrote, so I don't think I'll deny that. I think you're right.
How do you reconcile one of the first countries to have a woman leader, Indira Gandhi, with the conditions that most women put up with in their daily life?
Well, you have to realize that Indira Gandhi came out of a completely different tradition than women in India. I mean, She became prime minister largely because of her father, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was the founding prime minister of India. Her background was very much that of an upper-class, educated woman who had come from a family that expected her to have a profession. She did not do that much directly for women in India, and yet. She was of course an enormously powerful symbol, and many women told me that they just felt, you know, that many village women I spoke to said that they thought she was a very good leader, and they couldn't tell me exactly why, but they said, well, she was good because she was a woman. So that was an important factor, but I don't think Indira Gandhi, she was largely irrelevant to the concerns of most Indian women, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, for the time that you were in the cities of India, were most women forced to live in the kind of extreme circumstances of women in villages, or did women have a lot more freedom in the cities?
Well, what's interesting about India is that while there's been this large migration from the villages to the cities in recent years, the ways of the village are still largely followed in the cities, and not the other way around. So certainly there were women in the cities who did not leave their houses very much and go out. But yes, industrialization, urbanization was breaking down a bit of the old ways, and there were jobs in the cities for women in the cities than there were in the villages. So it wasn't quite as repressive in the cities, I would say. Although it was there was no guarantee. If you moved to the city, that you would find work, that life would be better.
Journalist Elizabeth Buemiller, her book on the women of India is titled May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons. She's now on maternity leave from the Washington Post and lives in Tokyo with her husband, Stephen Weissman, who reports for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.